are now plugged in to the Delphi podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. It's Tommy here, and I'm joined today by Robert Leshner, who is the king of Compound, which is the first on-chain money market protocol. Basically, you could just borrow and lend assets on there. Compound has $2.5 billion in TVL, and I think everybody knows them very well. And Robert has since moved on and founded Superstate, which allows bringing real-world assets or traditional assets on-chain. Robert, how's it going?
It's going great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Robert, I think it's wild that you are somebody that was so deeply and intimately involved with the lending and borrowing of on-chain assets away from the meat space physical world. And now you're basically turning that on its head, right? Bringing those real world assets to crypto.
That's right. It's almost like a reflection or an inverse of what I've spent a lot of time over the last 6 years doing.
Did you have to adjust your guiding light here? Or was there a big change mentally to be able to do that? Because most people, when they're fully engrossed in crypto, it's hard to go back to the real world.
Well, I think it's the same guiding light that I've had for a really long time. And I guess I'll take you back to the beginning, because I think it sort of explains where I, got this idea from and how I got to this point and, why Superstate is almost a continuation of everything I've been working on for so long. When I first started, pitching the idea of a DeFi protocol. I mean, this is before there was a phrase DeFi in 2017. I had this naive assumption that eventually all of the assets in the world would be operating on a blockchain, and that if you built a generalized protocol like a Compound or like any other DeFi application, the assets that it would be able to interact with and be composable with would start off, in the early days with, very crypto native assets, things like Ether, things like, tokens that were created for other applications. But over time, the asset list wouldn't just be crypto native assets. Over time, the assets would be, everything in the TradFi world, stocks and bonds and currencies and commodities and real estate and the stuff that there's, hundreds of trillions of dollars of, running off chain. And I really genuinely believed that, by this point, 6 years later, there would be more assets on chain. In the interim years, stablecoins were really the first asset to bring an asset from off-chain into a token form. Stablecoins have obviously had just massive product market fit. But aside from stablecoins, there's been very little, asset migration on-chain. It's still, for the most part, the same assets that have been operating on-chain for years now. There's obviously new projects that get created and new tokens that get created. But for the most part, any DeFi application, whether it's on Ethereum or another blockchain, really is only operating with pretty, similar list of crypto native assets, assets that don't live off chain. And so to me, this is surprising. It's been one of the biggest surprises, of my career is that, 6 years after, the initial idea for Compound, it still can't work with a lot of assets that I thought it would work with by now. And so this really led me to start asking questions of the industry, of institutional investors, of market participants, on what they thought was necessary for this market to evolve. And it led me to believe that, what had to be done was going back to TradFi and figuring out a way to get traditional assets on chain. Because, up until this point, aside from stablecoins being an absolutely incredible proof of concept of this, very little work had been successful. And so I just see this as the biggest opportunity to transform on-chain markets and on-chain assets if it's done correctly.
Why do you think it's been such a struggle? I mean, because that is a long amount of time, right? Since you've identified or hoped that real-world assets would come on-chain. Like you mentioned, it's been, call it 6 years or so. And I think not having done the diligence you've done, I always just presumed that, it was clunky having to deal with a, bureaucratic institution or a government agency or something in the old world to get a title transferred or to get that real world asset on chain. It just seems really clunky and hard to do, right? Is that something you're able to solve for, or is that maybe not the concern here?
Well, that's one of, a few major challenges. If we start at the beginning of your question, which was, it's been 6 years, why hasn't this happened? I actually think there's a few reasons why this hasn't really happened yet. The first one is a function of what attempts have been made and with what assets. A lot of the early experiments in tokenization really started with extremely esoteric assets. If you recall, there was a number of projects trying to tokenize a specific piece of real estate, you know, a building in some location. And tokenizing it, there was a number of projects trying to tokenize other esoteric assets. In general, I think a lot of the projects, you know, early on were not met with a lot of demand. I'm assuming that throughout this, you know, podcast, we can get into all the different, you know, ways of analyzing, you know, what is the demand for these assets and like why tokenize them in the first place. But I don't think there was that much purpose to bring a lot of these early experimental assets on chain. Just because, you know, these weren't sort of like widely demanded assets in their own right. You know, the market for, you know, some specific building in, you know, South Carolina is like, you know, there might be 12 investors who want to participate in that. It wasn't historically enough to build a market or grow a market around it. And I really think it was sort of like a demand side problem. What we've seen over the last, you know, couple years is, and I'll put stablecoins into this, you know, bucket of tokenized assets that have been successful, very obviously. You know, stablecoins found a huge amount of demand from people all over the world, in the US, ex-US, you know, who wanted to have dollars that they could. As a market participant, for me, I've been able to observe just a huge amount of demand for the asset. Demand in a way that there was never demand for the early tokenization projects that weren't just a dollar. You know, what's happened over the last 18 months is there's been, you know, this increasing demand for yield-bearing assets. And I think that's driving a lot of the next wave of tokenization projects in general. But, you know, the first answer to your question is, I think it was the wrong assets. There was no demand for them. And I don't think that created a positive feedback loop where other teams and other projects got excited about bringing assets on chain because the early ones weren't met with a warm reception.
Yeah, that's fair. I do remember a couple of those early experiments. I forgot the name of the companies, like you mentioned, tokenizing a building or a specific house or something like that. But it seems like you're targeting the biggest market out of the gate, right? Like allowing crypto participants to access T-bill yield, which was, you know, 5% or so. Unsure if that's going to come down anytime soon. Is that like, that's something that I think you've identified as probably, would you say that's the largest initial market for you? Or
yeah, that's without a doubt, I think one of the largest initial markets for tokenization in general. And it's because, you know, right now, you know, those yields are incredibly attractive that you mentioned. They're, you know, pretty much high watermarks for most people's memory, especially in financial market. And so there's a lot of demand for it. I mean, you know, a US Treasury is one of the greatest investments there is. If you're able to, you know, have an extremely low risk, you know, return that by most standards is really, really good. And so the second thing that I think is driving this demand potentially is the fact that those yields are higher than what's available on chain. And so you have a whole on-chain market basically saying, hey, you know, why would we want to earn less than 5.whatever% on chain when treasuries, which are a great asset, have a higher yield and lower risk? And, you know, I think that's really one of the causes of what's going to drive a lot of tokenization is just demand pulling assets on chain. And, you know, I think it's a great asset class. I think it's one of the first ones that's going to pull assets on chain in, you know, a follow-up to how dollars were initially pulled on chain through demand for them. And I think it's, you know, one of these killer applications and use cases for tokenization. And it won't be the last asset class that gets pulled on chain. You know, one of my beliefs is that eventually every asset class will find its way on chain because those assets are going to be able to do more than they currently do. But in terms of what comes first or next after stablecoins, I think treasuries and, you know, low risk, high yield assets are really ripe for migration.
It's pretty cool too. It's like that T-bill yield that you mentioned, like similar to kind of like the ETH staking yield, like that kind of becomes the hurdle limit, right? Or hurdle rate. Like, if you can't offer more than that as a DeFi project, you're kind of like dead in the water, right?
That's right. I mean, you know, historically, you know, when you take any like finance 101 class, you know, you always talk about, you know, the risk-free rate. And the risk-free rate is a theoretical concept, I mean, fundamentally, but, you know, it winds up as the logical beginning of most financial math in general. And things get really funky and you start to having to ask questions if, you know, things violate, you know, sort of the laws of financial physics. You know, right now today, a lot of crypto does, which, you know, I think is going to change and erode over time, is the risk-free rate becomes more prevalent on-chain.
there's a lot we could go into here, but I'm curious, like, what do you think that second order effect is for DeFi, right? If you make this risk-free T-bill rate, like, easily and globally accessible to crypto participants, treasuries, yada, yada, how does DeFi compete with that on the incentive side?
Yeah, well, I think what winds up happening is it sort of trickles into every other application. It trickles into AMMs, right? If you're a liquidity provider on an AMM, you start thinking about, you know, the alternatives to whatever the fees minus a permanent loan. If you're borrowing an asset, you might compare that interest rate to the readily available risk-free rate that you could then earn on the other side. If you're looking at, you know, where you're earning a yield, it has to be relative to the risk-free rate. I think it's hard to predict exactly what changes for how different applications are written or how they function. I think it's hard to predict what happens with individual assets. But, you know, I think as there's a greater prevalence of a risk-free rate on-chain, it will seep into pretty much everything else.
Yeah, I mean, even to your point, it sounds like that risk-free rate could float through to the products themselves, like, you know, just simple stuff. But I mean, treasuries can hold that T-bill rate and share the yield, or that the AMMs could have, you know, instead of being USDC, maybe it's a stable coin that flows that yield through to offset some of that IL. It sounds
Absolutely.
Like it could be involved.
Yeah, exactly. And it's possible it benefits all these protocols, right? You know, it's hard to say how things will get, you know, rebuilt and rewired.
So jumping off the script a little bit, it sounds like there's kind of like a narrative violation here, right? Like, we're bringing in, like, crypto is built to be this, I don't want to call it a hedge, but you can call it a debasement hedge, you can call it an inflation hedge, whatever you want to call it, in this world totally outside of the US government and meat space. And now we're onboarding, like, what we call that, you know, the safest yield in the world, which I agree with on the T-bill side. How do you kind of square this? Like, how do you put those two together?
Well, I don't think it's a narrative violation at all. And I actually think it's sort of like the destination where a lot of crypto is going. You know, to me, and I come at this as, like, you know, a DeFi person, you know, first and foremost, in my on-chain experience, you know, I didn't get into crypto, you know, as like a smash the state type thing. I got into crypto because the ability to program financial assets was just so profound of an innovation. And, you know, when I see all of this stuff evolving and coming on chain, I don't think that changes. I actually just think it gets more remarkable and more powerful. You know, we've been dealing with, for the most part, stable coins for the last 5 years. And, you know, stable coins are not this, like, fully on-chain, you know, censorship-resistant asset. You know, you can find examples, you know, where, oh, there's a purely Ether-backed, you know, collateral algorithmic stable coin. But, like, for the most part, like, we've already made these leaps where there are trust assumptions that aren't encapsulated entirely on-chain in pretty much all of DeFi today. And to me, it's not about, like, oh, this is like a purely trustless system end to end that's exciting. It's, hey, you can get assets where those assets are programmable and composable, and you do really cool things with them, like you've seen in DeFi, where you can have self-custody of assets and choose how you transfer, how you settle, how you move, how you program those assets. There can be off-chain trust assumptions that you as an investor, you know, are comfortable with. And it doesn't mean that DeFi or, you know, on-chain systems are any less awesome. I think that's, like, potentially the most awesome is when eventually we're going to be able to hold and program and settle all the assets that don't exist on-chain today, whether it's stocks or bonds or currencies or commodities or real estate or all these different things. Being able to do what you want with your assets is the whole reason that, you know, crypto is exciting to me.
Yeah, no, that's a really fair answer. And I mean, I think it's kind of interesting that we're seeing just how big of a buyer of government debt crypto is, right? Like, Tether owns, what is it, like 80, 90 billion of T-bills? Or I'm probably misquoting the numbers here a bit, but I think you get where I'm going with this, is that, I mean, eventually, I guess the US sort of has to come around to crypto given how much government debt crypto protocols will own. And I guess because stablecoins are basically exporting the dollar everywhere online.
Yeah. Well, I definitely think there's a give and take and trade-offs. I mean, you know, I think stablecoins are going to be seen over time as, you know, really powerful tools. You know, right now there's, you know, been sort of pending legislation for years. And, you know, I think there's still this expectation that they have to become more defined over time. And, you know, the role of the stablecoin will evolve. But I agree with you that fundamentally, stablecoins are incredibly positive for the U.S. economic system. You know, it takes the dollar and it makes it more viable and more useful and more transparent. You know, there's obviously fears, whether they're justified or not, around that. You know, you've seen a lot of this, you know, press recently around, oh, you know, our stable coins or our crypto being used, you know, in nefarious ways with, you know, international wars, you know, all of these things. And so there's like counter narratives that occur beyond, hey, this is making the dollar better. And so you're going to see two different camps figuring out collectively and from societal level, you know, what these assets mean and why they're good and like what are the downsides, you know, compared to the upsides in a very coherent way. And I think that'll, you know, long-term stable coins as well as all tokenized assets are going to shake out really well in that because the advantages dwarf the disadvantages. But I think it takes time for both sides to lay out their own narrative that they see these advantages or they see these disadvantages.
Yeah, no, that's a fair take. I'm hoping we figure it out relatively soon, but let's jump to some of the fun stuff with Superstate. So you guys launched initially, I believe it's live, with the T-bill fund. What do you think's on the roadmap next? Because you mentioned like a lot of the assets we tried to tokenize in the past were kind of esoteric. So you're kind of in this situation where you need to tokenize assets that are, you know, fundamentally value and have a huge market, but also are not esoteric or too specific, right?
Yeah. So, you know, to jump into where we're at today, so we don't have a product that's live yet. We have, you know, one product that we have, you know, submitted a draft prospectus to the SEC for the Superstate Short-Term Government Bond Fund. It's going to be, you know, quite some time to work through, you know, all of the nuances of launching a publicly registered tokenized fund. And so we don't have a fund that's live today. I think, you know, over time, you know, we're going to see, you know, additional products that Superstate launches, and we're going to be live in market. But, you know, as of today, we don't have anything.
Well, what is the process like, though, for, like, let's fast forward a bit. Let's say that fund is live. Like, what is the process to gain access to that T-bill yield as a crypto user?
Yeah. So, you know, hypothetically speaking, you know, once it's live, assuming there's, you know, no changes between now and then, the process is an individual would onboard onto the platform. They would specify, you know, which Ethereum addresses they control and identify with themselves so that they could add those as addresses to an allow list. And they would then be able to hold a tokenized share of a yield-bearing fund in a self-custody wallet that they, you know, over time, there might be additional functionality that gets unlocked. But, you know, as is currently proposed, the primary thing you would be able to do is take a traditional fund and hold it in a digital asset wallet that you control. This is, you know, a small iteration over some of the existing products out there. This is not a step function in terms of additional functionality yet. But the primary activity is, you know, being able to invest in a fund that holds short-term government debt and keep it in a digital asset wallet under your control. Whether that's at a custodian like Coinbase Custody or Anchorage, or whether it's in a multi-sig like a Gnosis Safe, or whether it's in a, you know, pure, you know, self-custody wallet, you know, like a Ledger hardware device, you'd be able to basically hold this fund in that format.
It's pretty cool. And just playing dumb a bit, but I'm curious because I'd rather walk through the process start to finish. The asset that the fund will hold, that is, like you mentioned, an investment in an existing T-bill fund, or is the fund itself going out and purchasing individual T-bills?
Yeah, the fund itself is going out and purchasing assets.
Okay, cool. So you're not, it wouldn't be a wrapper of another traditional fund, which is nice.
Nope.
Okay. So there's no like double fees here between like an existing TradFi entity and then Superstate.
Yeah, that's correct. I think some of the earliest experiments in tokenization, folks have gone out and like, you know, just wrapped somebody else's, you know, investment fund, which has its own advantages and disadvantages. But in the case of Superstate, the idea would be that, you know, we're an asset manager creating and managing new funds that themselves are tokenized.
No, that makes a lot of sense. So I guess one of my like weird fears, and I'm sure this is shared by other people, is that, you know, where the custody and kind of shutdown risk comes from, right? Like, let's say I'm a DeFi project, you know, I want to get yield. I put, you know, I have a great raise. I put $10 million with you. There's a bunch of token holders, or not with you, but in Superstate, right? And the government comes along and tries to figure out kind of where to screw me, right? Do you think that there's any way that they'll like seize that to kill or neuter a protocol, right? Because then if the protocol doesn't have access to the funds, they're kind of lost. I'm just kind of wondering where the risk factors are.
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, the one thing I'll state is that, you know, I think there's a very big divide between trustless assets and assets that require, you know, off-chain systems. Superstate funds are without a doubt going to be in the second camp, which is these are funds that have a significant off-chain component, you know, and through the combination of the fund administrator, transfer agent, manager of the funds, et cetera, you know, there will be a process to, you know, be able to, you know, respond to the needs of regulators, of courts, of, you know, other off-chain systems for many different reasons. And it's not going to be an entirely like trustless asset where, you know, once you hold it in your wallet, you know, that's it. Nobody can seize it. At the end of the day, there's an off-chain fund that holds assets and a token is, you know, a claim to those assets. And so I wouldn't think of a superstate fund as something that, you know, you would hold in order to evade responsibility. I would view it as, you know, something that you would hold if you're confident that you don't have any issues engaging with, you know, the outside world.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I think a lot of people have this like very binary thought processes. Like it has to be ultra decentralized or not decentralized. This sounds like it's in the middle, and I definitely think that there's a market for that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, you know, at the end of the day, creating investment funds is going to steer that close to being totally decentralized. You know, there's superpowers that exist that are extremely correlated to decentralized systems. You know, the ability to program an asset, the ability to transfer an asset, which, you know, will be available over time. You know, all the great sort of virtues of, you know, crypto that we've grown up with. But it has to be done in a way in which there's an understanding that there is a significant degree of, you know, off-chain control. And whether you call that centralization or, you know, have another phrase for it, you know, these are not censorship-resistant assets. This is not Bitcoin. This is not Ether itself. There's a risk of censorship.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And I mean, the treasury market itself is like massive. Like we're in our own little crypto bubble here. But I mean, if you're able to transition a single digit or some meaningful percent from the traditional way of accessing those funds to crypto, I mean, that's a massive market. I'm not sure how many trillions, but it would be in total size, but it would be quite large.
That's the dream.
So let's walk through like second order effects. Like what you mentioned that you're here for kind of, you know, the financial programmability, the new creativity we could do with financial assets, things like that. If you're able to onboard real world assets to crypto, what can you do outside of, you know, just a DAO allocating to T-bills, which is exciting, but are there new use cases? Is there new ways to get involved? Are there new things that you could do with those real world assets once they're in the crypto realm that you're excited about?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot that you can do. And I think like the whiteboard of creativity and designing new use cases and flows hasn't even started yet because we're really not even at the starting gun. And my expectation is that we're going to be surprised by the creativity of the market once it's allowed to flourish in a, you know, compliant and controlled way. You know, I think the basic use cases come down to, you know, long term, being able to transfer and trade and settle these assets and program them for that in, you know, new ways. You know, a great example is, you know, being able to use a fund as collateral with a counterparty. You know, let's say it's, you know, a prime broker and you're using it as a margin or, you know, with, you know, an OTC counterparty, you know, as a leg of a trade, you know, being able to program, you know, funds for settlement, for transacting is really powerful. You know, right now, a lot of the processes for settlement are so outdated. You know, there's oftentimes days of reconciliation baked into these systems. But one of the things that we've observed, you know, as a society over the last couple of years is that, you know, a well-built, you know, on-chain cryptographic system, you know, doesn't take days to settle a transaction. It's proactive in, you know, the code that's been created to enact settlements, so to speak, of transactions. And I can visualize situations where people, you know, program assets in ways to, you know, make their lives better. You know, oh, if, you know, I receive a notification from, you know, my prime broker that, you know, I need to post more margin, transfer this token. and do things that you really can't do today. And even though these things sound like simple and boring, I think it has the ability to transform finance by making the assets themselves programmable.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like, I mean, not to go back to the global or global discussion, but it sounds a lot like we're kind of just exporting the U.S. economy on chain a bit. Like, we're just allowing the world to access the real world assets that we have, the T-bills that we have, yada, yada. But I know that you're not solely focused on the U.S. itself.
Well, we are focused on the U.S. Maybe that's a misconception. We're focused on the U.S. market. So one of the hard things that we see is that there are so many companies that are focused on the ex-U.S. market because it's easier, because they don't have to deal with U.S. regulations, because they can, you know, go to market faster, because they can, you know, skip a lot of steps. That's not our view. You know, our view is that the U.S. market is worth participating in, it's worth focusing on. And, you know, there's a lot of friction to operating in the U.S., but it's one that, you know, we are up to the challenge to take on. And so we're excited about, you know, being able to build regulatorily compliant investment products in the U.S. And, you know, we're not going to turn our focus to, you know, just launching offshore to get around that.
Yeah, no, I'm glad we have teams focused on the U.S. It's definitely not the easier option, but it is great to see that you're focusing here.
It's definitely the harder option.
Yeah, no, definitely is. So let's fast forward a bit, like 6 months or a year out. What do you think will be the other real world assets that you tokenize? Like, if we had to go through like categories or groups, what do you think would end up being up there?
Yeah, so just speaking, you know, philosophically here, because, you know, I don't think there's, you know, a specific next fund that we're thinking about at this point, but just in terms of the asset classes that I think are going to wind up on chain, I think it's really a function of what's their demand for. Short-term government debt, there's a huge amount of demand for. You know, the second largest, I would say, is probably like longer-term government debt. The third highest, I'd say, is probably equities, you know, whether it's the S&P 500 or NASDAQ, like having some on-chain, you know, programmable, you know, equity exposure is actually really interesting. Commodities are really interesting. There's just so many different potential future funds that it's hard to say, you know, what's going to happen next.
The equity side is pretty interesting, right? Like the ability to trade stocks 24/7, 365, including on holidays. But on the flip side, we kind of lose what I love about crypto, at least, which is like that on-chain audibility, not having to wait for quarterly earnings. So you kind of have a mixing of two worlds, but it's definitely an improvement to the equity trading setup we have now.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think over time, you know, you're going to see innovation here from the TradFi side, as well as the, you know, crypto side. It doesn't make sense that, you know, most systems don't allow you to trade, you know, as equities over the weekend. You know, I know Robinhood recently rolled out, you know, non-market hour trading. There's going to be systems built that allow people to move away from like very legacy defined limitations. And there's a lot of ways that, you know, as a whole society, we're going to be chipping away at this lift. Some of it's going to come from just market structure on the traditional side, and some of it's going to come from, you know, market structure on the crypto side. It's, you know, being able to tokenize assets, you know, correctly.
Yeah, no, I'm excited for, it's funny they reinvented after hours trading, but I haven't looked into the Robinhood approach yet. So I guess zooming back out to Compound, Robert, do you see a world where Compound will eventually interact with Superstate? I'm sure this is probably a lob question you get often, but.
I mean, not in the short term. You know, I think long term, yes. I mean, long term, the goal is for there to be on-chain programmable assets that are compliant at an asset level where we, you know, can enforce that, you know, the holders of a tokenized share are who we think they are, but that those assets over time are composable with DeFi protocols. You know, whether it's, you know, for trading or settlement or, you know, some other use case, the goal is to get towards this on-chain composability of tokenized assets. And it's harder than stablecoins for many reasons, you know, but eventually I think this is the end state.
Yeah, I mean, thinking through like how Compound would interact with Superstate, and I mean, going out to like any DAO here, do you think it'll be relatively easy for a DAO to be able to allocate to a super state T-bill fund? Like, will the DAO have to have its entity? Will it have to be based in the U.S.? Like, what is the mark on, like, which DAOs can take part in this versus which DAOs cannot?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So participating as an investor in the fund, we've seen a lot of innovation here from, you know, DAOs like MakerDAO and Frax, and it oftentimes involves them creating an off-chain entity to hold assets, which seems like a relatively straightforward way for there to be a sort of meat space investor, so to speak, in a fund with, like, you know, very clear, you know, knowledge of what's the entity, who's involved with it, where the funds come from. It's how a lot of DAOs have gone off-chain. So I think that's one way that DAOs can, you know, allocate assets. I think some of it's, you know, untested and some of it has to be, you know, analyzed due to this specific, you know, sort of facts around, you know, what's occurring. But I think that's a viable path for DAOs, is to create off-chain organizations in addition to on-chain. And in terms of the assets themselves being composable with a DeFi application, that's a whole second order of complexity. And, you know, it's hard to see the exact path by which that occurs right now, but it's going to increasingly occur over time.
Yeah, I mean, one good example here is just like MakerDAO, right? Or just MakerDAO, like large decentralized stablecoin DAI, like that protocol. Like, they're allocating a lot to real world assets. And honestly, I haven't dug into it specifically, but I'm pretty sure they're allocated pretty heavily to T-bills, right?
They are, yes. And, you know, the reason why they're able to do that is because, you know, backing DAI is a large amount of another stablecoin USDC, which, you know, doesn't generate yield while it sits on chain, but does generate yield for their DAO when it's moved off chain. And so, you know, they're one of the best examples of, you know, sort of reverse tokenization, where they take assets that were on-chain assets and move them off-chain. And it's really interesting to watch, but they've, I think, gotten pretty skilled at that process.
Yeah, I mean, the DAI issuance is north of $5 billion. Like, it's a...
Yeah,
they must have a lot in T-bills. I'm not sure how much, but it's got to be a good chunk. But basically what you're saying is, for someone like Maker, they have a pretty specialized team to do this specifically for them. Your take is that most DAOs will want to outsource that work to a provider like Superstate.
No, that's not necessarily what I'm saying. I'm saying, like, Maker has a specialized team that's set up to be able to invest the assets of their protocol off-chain. And a lot of DAOs don't at this point. So a lot of DAOs would not be in a position to be able to invest in a fund.
Okay, from a structuring perspective, or
yeah, from a structuring perspective,
okay,
getting the
that
assets,
makes a lot of sense.
You know, from an on-chain, you know, starting point to an off-chain organization.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's definitely not easy to do. I'm not sure what structuring goes into it, but I know it's probably complicated.
Yeah, I'm sure we could go on the MakerDAO forum and read all about the processes.
Yeah, Robert, at what point do you think this becomes like the norm, like where projects are heavily invested, where it's not like hearsay to have exposure to T-bills as a crypto project? Like, I know you're working on making that the norm, but it still feels a little, you know, not ick in the minds of crypto, but there's definitely like a break here between the two camps.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't think this is going to be the primary source of activity, you know, 5 years from now. I think you're going to have on-chain systems with huge amounts of assets, and some of them will sort of like go off chain for their yield. But over time, I think there's going to be more and more stuff on chain. I don't know. It's hard to say, like, to predict, you know, the ecosystem of DAOs and what they do. But I definitely think that certain organizations will level up and become Maker-like, and that they get really good at off chain, you know, investing in off chain systems. And most of them won't have those skills and will stay on chain and just look for what assets are available. You know, I've observed so many DAOs saying, like, oh, we have Ether and we turned it into Lido staked Ether as a form of treasury management. Like, so many DAOs do that because, you know, it's on-chain and it's permissionless and it's very easy for them because it doesn't require any off-chain expertise or infrastructure. And so, you know, I kind of see, you know, a lot of that staying the case for the most part, but we'll see.
Yeah, no, we definitely will. Let's talk about the landscape a bit. I'm not sure who you view as your key competitor. But I mean, there's projects out there like Ondo Finance that are doing similar things. Yeah, what would you say of like the competitive landscape for Superstate now?
I don't think anyone's a competitor when the market is 0.5% of what the market's going to become. It makes no sense to, you know, fight or snipe or worry about others at all when this market is so tiny compared to what it's going to be. And, you know, it makes way more sense to focus on bringing in new market share as opposed to worrying about what other folks are doing. So I really don't think there's any competitors for how we're thinking about this. I think there's, you know, other teams exploring tokenization in a variety of different ways. And I think a lot of that's going to be a tailwind for all of us. Everything we do is going to improve the shared knowledge of what works and doesn't work for everybody. Everything that they do is going to improve the shared knowledge of what works and doesn't work for everybody. And so in that sense, you know, because the market today is such a pittance of what it'll become over time, I actually wish there was more peers in the market trying new things, because all of us will go farther.
I haven't heard of many founders asking for more competition, but I love it.
Well, it's not my first rodeo, so.
No, I know. And how exactly, like, just taking it a step further, though, how would multiple competitors compete here, though, right? Like, if there are, like, let's call it 2-3 services offering access to T-bill yield for a DAO, like, do you compete on lower fees? Do you compete on less centralization risk? Do you compete on less KYC? Like, or is it all the same, kind of?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting question. I mean, I don't think the majority of Superstate customers will be DAOs. As a great example, like, I you know, it's not at the top of my mind for the sort of investors that I think are going to be pursuing this. I think, you know, most of the folks that are going to be, you know, interested in this to start with are institutional-like investors in the crypto space that are looking for alternatives to stable, where they already have a digital asset infrastructure set up and, you know, they might have just a lot of dry powder in their fund. And I view those as probably the more likely types of investors over DAOs.
Yeah, I mean, the search for yield is, like, I think Coinbase offering 5% on USDC is just insanely underrated as a business move. Like, I think that was genius. Like, just showing consumers around the world that they could transfer from their bank account to Coinbase and earn 5% for doing nothing is wild. And I'm sure it's a similar sell for you.
I mean, it's wild. And to be honest, I'm actually shocked that the numbers for USDC haven't gone up more as a response to it.
Me too.
It's surprising, to be frank.
Why do you think that is? Do you think people just don't know about it and they're going and buying like T-bill funds and Schwab and Vanguard and Fidelity? Or like, what's the...
Yeah, it's a good question. I think most likely what's happening is, you know, they're attracting the existing stablecoin supply. It's not leading people to say, oh, I want more stablecoins. Like, I think it's more of a, hey, I was earning zero. Now it's really ridiculous to earn zero if I can earn 5% on this. Let me just park it with Coinbase. And, you know, my gut would be that they are successful because, you know, if you have a stablecoin and you're already a Coinbase customer, why wouldn't you? But you can just see in the numbers that it hasn't grown the overall supply. And so it's interesting. I mean, I definitely know a number of people that have moved their assets to Coinbase because of it.
Yeah, no, it's just super simple. They have an opt-out button for USDC, like if you don't want the yield. And I was laughing, like, who would ever click that? But I'm sure they're out there.
I know. I mean, USDC supply is like pretty much at, you know, local lows. You know, we're back to mid-2021 market cap.
It's wild. Yeah. What are you watching for there? Like, do you view an increase in USDC supply as bullish for crypto as people move funds back? Or is it a decrease in supply as they, you know, they allocate? Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, a contract in supply is probably bullish because it probably means that stablecoins are rotating into non-stablecoin assets. Stablecoins, you know, buying Bitcoin and Ether and, you know, the volatile assets. And then, you know, over time, those stablecoins being redeemed. But if the yields between stablecoins and traditional assets, you know, reach a parity or reach an equilibrium, you know, it's possible that stablecoin balances never go down. They only go up. And, you know, even if stablecoins are being used to buy assets, whoever's on the other side of that trade is not going to be redeeming their stablecoins to cash out.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. So I'm not our macro expert, and I'm sure that they'll yell at me for asking the wrong question. But like, the basis of Superstate's first fund is based off high yields, right? The idea that people want to allocate, they want to earn, their assets are sitting idle, they're earning nothing. Do you have a view on where rates are going? And I know that's an extremely loaded macro question with a lot of levers, but yeah.
Yeah, that's, you know, anyone who tries to forecast macro gets it wrong way more often than they get it right. If I have to take a guess that I'll be embarrassed about a year from now, you know, it'll be my, you know, Delphi podcast embarrassing forecast.
That's fine. We need some.
Yeah. I don't think there's any more hikes. I think we're at the terminal rate on the upside. And, you know, I'm just bootstrapping a little bit off the two-year rate right now. I think rates go down to like 4% over the next couple of years.
Okay. Still attractive, not, though, for a super state.
Yeah, yep. Still attractive, but not like we're hitting a hard recession. Rates are going down to 1% again. I think we get to, you know, about a 3.5 to 4%, you know, rate from here, and everyone waits and sees.
Yeah, I just think it's so ironic that you'll have international DAOs and customers and funds allocating to Superstate for projects built in foreign countries that the U.S. doesn't allow. It's like, hey, don't build here, but we'll accept your money to buy our debt. It's,
I mean, one day, yeah.
Yeah, it's wild. So, Robert, just switching gears a bit, I'd be dumb not to ask you like life lessons from Compound. You know, I have a bunch of questions here, but I think my first one is just the shift from Compound to Superstate. Like, you clearly could have packed it up, retired, called it a day. And I know we joked about this in person, but what was the gap between, you know, your decision to kind of build Superstate and to not move on from Compound, but I guess just switch gears?
Yeah, I mean, you know, really the last like 3 years, you know, even when I was, you know, still at Compound Labs, my focus was on this bridge between traditional financial markets and on-chain financial markets. One of the projects I spent most of my time on was called Compound Treasury. And Compound Treasury was operating in a very similar space in that, you know, it was a project that was trying to work with institutions to help them earn a yield based on on-chain financial markets. And, you know, this was a, probably a really good idea 3 years ago when on-chain was still higher yield than off-chain. You know, when all of crypto sort of imploded, I should say all CeFi crypto imploded, and it simultaneously occurred against a backdrop of inflation and rising interest rates, suddenly the idea of Compound Treasury looked kind of ridiculous. You know, it was like, well, why would I want an on-chain yield when I can get an off-chain yield? And there was that tipping point, the flippening, so to speak, between, you know, off-chain and on-chain. But I spent the last couple of years really focused on this problem. And, you know, we were able to launch a product, attract a lot of customers and investors, and like demonstrate a similar flow, you know, off-chain dollars making their way on-chain to earn a yield. And after the implosion of pretty much every one of those 2022 businesses, you know, this idea of, you know, on-chain yield for institutional investors coming from off-chain was less and less and less and less attractive. And it really, you know, required, you know, me and some of the team over there to say, well, what are the alternatives? Like, what is going to work and why? And, you know, we really, you know, came up with this idea for Superstate. And once that idea bug bit me, I was like, well, this is what I want to pursue. You know, this needs to be built.
Absolutely no vacation. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No vacation. I mean, so, you know, for me, it wasn't a hard decision. I think that Superstate has the opportunity to be, you know, incredibly important for creating financial products that make their way on chain, demonstrate a lot of new technology, a lot of tokenization, and think about, you know, the macro for like, why should DeFi exist in the first place from sort of the opposite end of the telescope.
That's really cool. You find Superstate, and after founding Compound, there's clearly a lot of things that you probably thought of, like, you know, hey, I did these, you know, five things wrong, or I'm going to do these things differently. This is how I'm going to build Superstate because of, you know, how Compound panned out, and this is what I want to do to streamline things. What were those things in your head that you said, hey, you know what, I'm going to do it differently building Superstate because of what I've learned with Compound? What were those things?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, you know, just in terms of working with the market and working with customers, I mean, you know, Compound didn't start off with an institutional focus. It started off with a build technology that nobody has ever seen before focus. And it led to, you know, some really cool products and really cool systems and really cool, you know, libraries of solidity and really cool things that benefited so many people. And, you know, it didn't really start off with, you know, this like user persona focus that Superstate has. And at Superstate, we spend a lot of time talking about institutional investors and, you know, the requirements that they have and, you know, their preferences. And it's just fundamentally a different experience. You know, it's building institutional financial products as opposed to building, you know, a completely novel and completely new, you know, technological application. And so there's a lot that's different from the origin of it. You know, the team that we're building is, you know, very focused on just serving an institutional market. And you know, it's not based on, you know, any learnings from my experience with Compound, besides the fact that, you know, the systems that institutions want, you know, don't necessarily exist yet and they have to be built.
I guess there was a point in Compound's life where you decided, I don't want to say to keep it simple, but to not pursue every single, you know, area of growth, right? To not continue pounding the pavement on every single way that you could draw capital in and expand the user experience. I mean, is my kind of view right from the outside that you decided, let's keep Compound simple? You know, I could have more impact maybe doing Superstate, or am I kind of thinking about that the wrong way?
No, it's interesting. I mean, you know, Compound Labs is, you know, different from Compound the protocol. And there's obviously a lot of different views on, you know, what it takes for the protocol to succeed versus what it takes for development. You know, company really shifted its focus to succeed. I had spent the last few years focused on a couple sort of things. You know, one was at Compound Labs, we decided to build a layer one blockchain, you know, that if anyone remembers was, you know, colloquially called, you know, Compound Chain for a while, but internally it was called Gateway. And, you know, that was a very different focus. It didn't pan out. And then, you know, we had this focus on, you know, Compound Treasury, which was like a bridge between the trad world and the crypto world. And that didn't really pan out either. And so, you know, to sort of take a hard reset and step away and start something entirely new, you know, I think it was the right time.
You definitely tried multiple things that were big lifts. I mean, launching your own chain.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's clearly not, by no means downplaying that incredible work. And I guess like looking at what you're seeing in DeFi today, like you're one of the fathers of DeFi, right? And looking at, I don't know if you'd call it like DeFi V2 or V3 or whatever we're calling it now, but do you have any takes on what's being built now? Do you have any advice for founders? Is there anything that's, you know, super interesting to you or you feel is wrong? I'm kind of lobbing a bunch of questions your way so you could take it any way you want, but I'm more so interested on, you know, one of the godfathers of DeFi's view on what's being built now.
Yeah, well, the way I look at this is over the last couple of years, you know, I've spent a lot of time investing through a fund called Robot Ventures that has been investing in a lot of early stage fintech and crypto projects. And, you know, the things that, you know, get me excited really fall down into a couple buckets of investment opportunities. You know, one is people innovating on the sort of core pillars and building blocks of DeFi, being able to do things differently, better, and new. I'm really not excited by the 803rd rebuild or fork of Uniswap or the 803rd, you know, rebuild or fork of Compound or Aave or whatever. It's like, it's not interesting. But the people that are trying new things, like fundamentally new, are exciting to me. So
I like that. Robert, we did a venture series and I have a lot of venture guests often. And you did mention you invest the robot. But one of the key differences is you've built a massive DeFi protocol. So the questions you ask founders are probably very different than the questions I ask founders. What is your, you know, Tarun isn't on, it's just one-on-one, you and a founder, a DeFi project. Like, what are the first couple of questions you get into?
Yeah, I mean, I like to ask why people are building what they're building, you know, knowing that people can build anything. I find a lot of people are doing things because they think investors will be excited about it, as opposed to doing it because they're excited about it. You know, they do it because they think it's going to be successful or able to attract capital. That's like sort of the first question that I find people stumble with or they get weeded out by. My other questions are usually around just like founder tenacity, you know, trying to get a sense of, you know, how far they're going to go if things aren't working at the get-go, if there's no product market fit, and understanding your sort of level of just like motivation. I try to get a sense of their, you know, technical capabilities. You know, anyone can put a pitch deck together for some totally novel, you know, financial product, but being able to sort of will it into existence from a technology perspective, a marketing perspective, you know, it's just really hard. So just trying to like get a sense of, you know, where the skill sets lie and what the gaps are, because, you know, oftentimes I tell founders, well, like, here's where I think your gap is, like, you know, oh, you know, we can fix that. You know, you should probably add to the team. So I just try to get a sense of all these things. And I sort of, you know, weigh then just against like, what are they building and like, how big can it get? You know, it comes down to a lot of times, you know, is there a market for this? A lot of things start off and they look really small, but turns out there's a huge market under the surface. And, you know, I just try to like really get to know founders, because at the end of the day, you know, we do a lot of pre-seed and seed investing. The team is all that matters. You know, if you have a great team that is able to plug gaps in their skill set, you know, is incredibly motivated and likes what they're working on, it doesn't matter whether it works or not, they're going to find something that works. And, you know, that's how I sort of like think about other founders in the space and, you know, who I'm excited to back and work with.
I love that. I love that take. I totally agree. It's all about the team at the early stage. One like follow-up question though, how exactly do you judge that motivation? Like anybody could lie to you. Anybody could be excited. Is it like a deep story about something they struggled with and they're trying to solve? Is it, you know, something that's a perfect fit for their skill set? Like what is the, how are you satisfied with the question on their motivations?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of things like you can sort of look at what they've accomplished to date. You can, you know, look at the path that got them there. You can look about at what they've done so far, right? You know, there's a big difference between, you know, a team that has made a pitch deck versus a team that like prototyped something in Excel first versus a team that, you know, went out and didn't know Solidity, but like taught themselves Solidity, you know, to be able to build a version 0.01. Like you can sort of intuitively in pattern matching, like get a good sense of a team, just, you know, based on what they're bringing to the table.
I love that. Robert, it's been awesome to have you on. I definitely want to do another episode on robot ventures when you're around. I feel like there's a lot we could talk about there.
Would love to.
Awesome. Robert from Compound, now Superstate. And Robert, sorry, last point for you. Where can people get involved with Superstate? I know you said the fund isn't live yet, but yeah. Where should people?
Yeah. We're always looking to hire great people. info@superstate.co or Superstate Funds on Twitter. Would love to hear from you.
Awesome. Thank you, Robert.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom. That was great.